this idea of change, you know, and for Aristotle, change is, and development, you know, development from potentiality to actuality is again a process of this form. It's like growing from sapling to, you know, 100-year oak is part of the form of what the tree does and always has and always, you know, will be. And this is, you know, Lear contrasts this actually quite well with, you know, the Humean conception, which I think some of us are more, seems more intuitive when it comes to the idea of causation or the idea of change, right? Like Hume uses the famous example of like the pool balls on the table, right? Like, you know, you see one pool ball, you know, kind of roll and hit another pool ball, and you think that that's simply just, you know, that you saw a cause, right? That one hit the other and it made the other roll. But really, you know, Hume would say you never actually see cause. You just see individual events, and, you know, our interpretation through inference over time, you know, makes us believe that there's, or we interpret that there is some sort of causation there, but we don't actually see causation. Whereas for Aristotle, like, if we're going to call it causation, you know, causation is part of like the organic existence of whatever entity that is developing, you know, right? Like he uses the example of like the house being built. Yeah. It's not that there's like, you know, a house coming to be, right, that involves a builder and material and structure and the form of the home and all this kind of stuff, right? You know, it doesn't, it's not like it's just like one little event after the other. It's actually one holistic process, right? Like, you know, just placing one brick on top of one other brick as like, you know, one event, you know, happening, what we essentially cause, like, you know, some sort of event of causation or change, you know, really isn't like, that's not the house being built. That's zeroing in on something that's kind of like irrelevant. And really you have to look outwards, or you have to kind of swim back and see the whole process taking place, right? Like there's the builder, there's the material, there's the idea, there's the structure, there's the skill, there's the house coming to be, there's the reason for the house existing. And all of these things, again, are part of the form of what a house is, right? From its concept, you know, from, you could say, its birth, like its building, to like its eventual decay, right? You know, if it's left and abandoned and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And that, like, all, again, all of that is subsumed under this idea of the form of the house, that is all part of the same sort of structure and processy, and that you can't just look at like one point and say, oh, there's the event of the house, you know, of the brick, or there's the event of the sewing, or there's the hammering. It's all sort of the same thing, or there's one piece of the material or whatever. It's all the same stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. It's all, I mean, if you think about it holistically, which is to say that you kind of think about them interdependently, you'll see that it doesn't really make sense for a brick to just be placed somewhere, right? That, which is the material cause. That brick is the material cause because of the final cause, that you're going to construct something out of it. It's a building material. The brick, it has certain properties that make it an appropriate building material. And it also is intertwined with the efficient cause, a particular builder who has the insight into the purpose and knows that that material is the material to use, right? So they can be analyzed. You can abstract them into parts, which I think is what is really appealing about this, this kind of, you know, way of approaching Aristotle's metaphysics, is that it is a very... it's a clean way of breaking up cause, but we can lose sight of the relation of these things when we get impressed by how we can be impressed by how easy these things can be disentangled from one another, right? And we lose sight of how they kind of are already related to each other prior to our analysis of these things. But it does show you why analysis of this thing is, it's good philosophy, because it does reveal to you something, right? I mean, when you're constructing a house, it's built out of something, it's built by someone, it's built for some purpose. And you might have lost sight of that if you were just looking at houses being built, right? It does show you that there are reasons that things exist. Essentially, but at the end of the day, what Aristotle wants to say is that all of those things are kind of, I don't want to say like meanings to the form of something, but when you analyze the form into its responsibilities, into why it's been caused, why it has been formed that way, it informs the form of something. So like a building, right?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's the desire to understand. Jonathan Lear kind of in his own title sort of hints at this, that, like, you know, Aristotle's at the end of the day is asking, okay, we want to get, like, we ask why, like, what's the why of something, right? Like, and it's clearly not, as you just said, like, you know, just this one brick being moved or just this one pool ball. It's like even Hume's pool example was kind of like super reductive, because it's sort of like, oh, you see one cue ball hitting another and it moves over in terms of causation. But really, that's missing the point of the fact that, like, pool is a game, right? Like, and like, pool involves people who are playing that game. There's a historical context to that game. You know, it's built out of certain things. It's, you know, the people play it for certain reasons, et cetera, et cetera. And, like, so when you ask, like, why is the pool ball, like, you know, rolling and hitting and moving the other one, it's not just, like, you know, an event that we see as a cause. It's actually a whole wraparound of this primary form of the game pool, which is inclusive of both the players, the material, the rules, all these sorts of things that, like, get kind of missed when you just focus on, like, one little instance of what we're concerned with, you know, causation.
Yeah, it's the whole network of things, right? I mean, like, think even about as subtly as, like, the sound that pool balls make when they hit each other. It's, you can hear it when I say that. It's a very, it's an oddly consistent sound across pool balls. And there's probably a reason that they're constructed out of the things that they were constructed out of. And that is to make that sound even, right? I mean, there is a whole network of reasons that things are the way they are. There probably is something about the sound of a pool ball that is responsible for pool being a thing, right? It's the whole network of subtleties. And I think that's also goes to, like, what Aristotle is doing with his four causes as well, is that it's not just, again, maybe I'm belaboring this a little bit, but it's not just the analysis of things into its parts, but for Aristotle, the relations of those things are where the insight is, right? And to go back to this idea of, like, the desiring to understand, it's not just so that we have, you know, the four causes and now we know these things. These are supposed to these are supposed to illuminate our experience of beings, right?
Yeah. And I think that, you know, the term that kind of comes up, you know, we don't want to get too much in the weeds of it, but we've heard it before, is, you know, the term logos, right? That there's an inherent intelligibility in any sort of phenomena or entity or activity or organism. And that logos is kind of representative of the essence, in the sense of, like, it is an understandable thing, right? And it's understandable, you know. And that really, when we look at, you know, from the, you know, when we look at things from, say, a material perspective, or we look at things from an efficient perspective, or we look at things from a formal perspective, we're really just looking at the same phenomena from different views, which are all part of the same logos, the same sort of intelligibility that makes that being whole and sensical and understandable to us. which then reflects back into, okay, well, like, Aristotle's conception of, like, the human person and their relationship to the world as an intelligible place. But I think that that's probably a next episode discussion. So as we, you know, I think we've kind of belabored, but at the end of the day, it's, I would just say for listeners, like, when we think about Aristotle and those four causes and the idea of form, really think about form as the primary, as like the essence in a sense, and that the four causes, these four aspects, are just really different sides of the same thing, right? They're all the components that make the thing an intelligible entity.
Yeah, I think the key, it's good to end on that as far as Aristotle here, is intelligibility, right? If Aristotle is revising Plato's conception of form, and Plato wants to say that there's an intelligibility that is sort of commensurate with mathematics and geometry and whatnot, Aristotle wants to be conservative of that. He wants to have an intelligible universe like that, but also to be able to explain change. He wants to be able to explain how things come into being and how they cease to be in an imminent world.
Let's move on from there to Charles Taylor, because I know that's what you've been reading recently.
Yeah, so I've been going through Charles Taylor's book, The Language Animal, which is actually kind of a run-up to another work that he later released, which is Cosmic Connections, which is an exploration of post-romantic poets. In both of the works, he is exploring theories of language, contemporary theories of language, and specifically he's comparing and contrasting like two different schools of theories of language. We had an episode on where we actually explored the first section where he lays out that agenda a little bit ago, but just as a by way of a recap, Charles Taylor wants to argue that there's kind of two historical schools to the philosophy of language, at least in the West. He calls the first one the HLC, which stands for Hobbes, Locke, and Condillac, and he groups them together as kind of these analytic types who have theories of language where language is more or less just reference, that language is us referring to a world that pre-exists. You have stuff before you and you want to talk about it. So you come up with names and you use those names to talk about things. And everything is more or less just a name for something that exists in the world. He wants to contrast this school of thought to what he calls the HHH theory. So the three H's of this school are Hamann, Herder, and Humboldt, but he more or less talks exclusively about Herder. In any case, these theorists say that it isn't just the fact that there is a world and it exists prior to us talking about it. There's actually something about language use that somehow is constitutive of that world, right? When we speak, we're not just coming up with words to talk about the world by pointing at it. When we speak, we're actually constituting that world in some important way. We're constituting new meanings. We're forming new practices and conventions. So that's basically the agenda, that Charles Taylor wants to argue for and argue for the correctness of the constitutive theories versus the referential theories.
The constitutive theory of language I kind of lean towards, and I think particularly on our online with like present media and stuff like that. As funny enough, as you were saying that, I was thinking about, you know, people like interesting characters out there like Cavicula and the Maxing communities. Those processes of these sort of online communities and these communities obsessed with certain subjects, as they're operating and growing and sort of organically happening, there's also a linguistic change that's going on, right? Like they create, that's one of the things that people have actually talked about with all these the Maxing communities, the Lux Maxing communities, is there's a whole new sort of lexicon that goes along with that. And that lexicon is like obviously referring to certain things in a way, but it's also an active process of sort of propagating and making real the things that these people are talking about and concerned with.
Yeah, I mean, like, let's take like gesture maxing, right? Like, so here's a good question that is sort of problematic. It's like a problematic to put on the table, right? Like, was gesture maxing a thing before people started using the word gesture maxing? For those who don't know, gesture maxing is like kind of making a fool out of yourself and intentionally doing so for some kind of like, because like in a particular situation, yeah, some clout or something. It's also like used as an insult sometimes. You're like, you're, bro, you're gesture maxing to like say that you're being dumb, basically. But more, the point is like, according to the HLC theories, gesture maxing was like some practice that actually existed, and then we just gave it that term, right? Whereas here on the constitutive theories, there's actually something about the language, you know, the like looks maxing language that makes gesture maxing a possibility, right? It's that something that you can, it's a possibility that exists imminent within the language that is yours to go out and kind of express that potentiality of that particular language. Of like a particular person or like a culture. Yeah.
I think funnily enough, like, you know, the maxing stuff is actually a pretty good example of this because, you know, it was being a jokester or making a fool of yourself. Like, has that already been a thing? Of course it's already been a thing, but the maxing component and the new lexicon around it, turns it into something more specific than it's a, you know, a particular kind of situated, you know, foolishness, right? It's a particular kind of situated insult that like it only makes sense within the lexicon of this whole sort of maxing online trolling aggressive community or whatever, right? And it sort of like propagates and energizes itself. And you even said, right, like that, you know, it goes from, you know, the term gesture maxing, which is hilarious, goes from, you know, being like, oh, you're doing this for, it can, you know, initially be like, oh, you're doing this for clout, you're intentionally acting foolish, to also being an insult, right? And that's like, you know, that's like an organic transformation, right? Like, people, insults have already been around, but like now this is a particular kind of insult in a particular kind of context in a particular kind of linguistic community. And it's actively propagating itself as it's being used.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's definitely the more like explanatory theory as far as like, how does, cause like, okay, let's take the HLC theories at their word and say like, okay, gesture maxing was like a thing and people came along and finally gave it the right word. But if that's true, how do you explain that kind of transition from gesture maxing as like, I'm going to do this as like a practice, you know, sometimes it's kind of like maybe almost like self-inflicted negging in a way, where you like do something bad to yourself and but it at the same time like kind of boost your clout or whatever like that, to how do you explain the meaning shift, right? Because if language is just pointing at stuff and giving it a name, that doesn't really explain how you evolve new meanings out of that, right? Because if you're just pointing and giving it the same word, I mean, I guess you could assign it like a new definition, but then there would have to be some like objective thing that is changing in front of you. But at the same time, both meanings kind of exist. But the point I'm saying is like, it's not as if there are just things out there that we point at and we give them meanings. Our meanings evolve with the things that change because guess what? those things evolve because we use language differently. It's not as if there's things objectively out there whose meanings are changing. We're using the language differently. We see that, like, okay, the guy, you know, the guy who we like follow around and who is making a clown of himself all the time, he's actually being really stupid right now. And so we're going to say, bro, you're jester maxing. And he's not going to get it, but everyone else gets it because they get that he's being stupid, and we're expressing some new meaning by turning what was otherwise like a positive within this lexicon, you know, maxing. You're always trying to max something out. There's never anything that you're like toning down. You're never trying to be cool. You're never trying to like lower anything. Even in like these communities, you know, you're trying to like lower cortisol, whatever. You're actually like, it's not as if there's like cortisol minning. You're just maxing the opposite of it. You're always trying to do that. So you can turn that as an insult. It's genuinely subversive when you like, and that's why it's a new, that's why it's a genuine new meaning. And that's why it catches on, is it's trying to express something new within the language that those people are using, right?
Yeah, and I think there's a, like a finer or like more primary kind of like ontological, you know, split going on here within like this idea of language, right? Where we have like the HLC, there's almost this kind of like Cartesian, like primary psychological, like internal psychological, you know, space that's seen as primary. And then it's like, you know, and then you assign, like, it's like, you know, we exist, you know, in our heads or whatever. And then we assign meanings to things out in the world. Whereas like the HHH model, you know, quite well presented, actually, funnily enough, through this whole Max community, is like, no, this is like the language is actually an active part of this organic community's construction and activity, right? Like, there was no like official assigning moment of like, okay, you know what, like this specific thing is jester maxing. Everything that's like this now, we're going to call jester maxing.
Yeah, there isn't like some central authority of what this is, right?
Jester maxing, you know, like, became a term that people like started using and use in correlation with other behaviors, communal ideals, political ideals, whatever. And they all sort of fit holistically together as like the same movement, the same processes. The HLC, like just kind of like basic, like language as reference, it's just always had this problem of, you know, kind of being like one step behind in a way like this. Like, it's like, you know, like language is like clearly a creative process and happens alongside with, you know, events and ideas and politics and whatever, right? And, you know, who, like, as you said, like, who's this central authority, like, assigning after we start seeing, it's almost like this human, inference idea where it's like, oh, we see this guy, like, clowning, like, acting like a clown on Twitch, like, enough times, and someone's, like, jester maxing, assigned, as we've assigned the word now, like, blah, blah. It's like, no, like, that's, like, in effect, like, for example, like jester maxing, like using that term is also like a form of bullying, right? Like, that's an activity that's happening linguistically along with the actual terminology.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, yeah, kind of going back to what you were saying too, on like the Cartesian, like the Cartesianism of the HLC as well. Like, that's the point that Herder wants to make, is that the HLC presupposes the existence of, or the phenomena of language, right? Like, if you are trying to say that, let's explain how language came about. One day we came along and we pointed at a thing and made a sound, and then we started doing that, and language is the reference of sign and signified. Well, that doesn't exactly explain how our connection between those things came about, right? That's just the first instance of it. The question is, how did we start doing that as an activity that is referring to things, right? So the HLC theory completely presupposes the whole of language in its explanation, which Herder, Charles Taylor is good about it. Herder himself kind of does the same thing, but Charles Taylor says that the seat of where you would actually get some kind of explanation of language use and the origins of that is in the constitutive theory. If language is an activity, which it is, when we speak, we are doing something, you can start to go on from activities. This is the whole point with Wittgenstein, right? Think about building a house. Try to imagine what that activity looks like without doing language. You can't do that without language. Language is constitutive of that activity, right? It's kind of like the mortar and then all the stuff that you see with your eyes are the bricks. But the mortar is there holding the bricks together, right? People are ordering things or repairing, ordering things to be repaired. They're saying, you know, put this here. They're measuring things. They're calculating things in language. So language is an activity, but you can go backwards. You can say, okay, maybe we were doing things, and then one day that activity evolved into using language to speak about it. And that's a much, the leap isn't like, the presupposition isn't there because they're the same thing. You're on the one hand, pre-linguistic activity, and the other hand, linguistic activity. Well, they're both kind of activities. Explaining where the linguistic aspect comes about is another sort of question, which Charles Taylor goes into in his own ontogenesis of language. If there's going to be a theory that can do it, it's going to be the constitutive theory, because it's at least like an enactmental theory.
There's something almost kind of frozen about HLC, right? Like, you know, like language is obviously an activity. It's obviously happening. Again, thinking about like online communities and like how quickly this linguistic processes goes along with other processes. But it's like language is constantly changing and renewing and, you know, reforming and working within the activities of all the other stuff that's going on, this sort of holistic sphere of just, you know, activity, the life world, whatever you want to call it. If the HLC formation was true, like, it also begs, like, why would language change? Like, if we all just agree, you know, that, like, you know, Joker is the term, then, like, why wouldn't we just all stick with Joker, right? Like, you know, like, why do we have to add the maxing on or whatever, right? Like, it precludes any sort of evolution, which is obvious in human and social activity.
Yeah, it precludes particularity, right? If these things are just like variables that you could put an X on, then how do you explain the emergence of, like, I guess, like, particular languages that people are learning because they're learning to do this activity? Sure, but they're completely arbitrary, but we don't experience that, right? Like, the term jester maxing is that because of a very particular, like, concatenation of terms within a, like, an online subculture.
And you've been listening to Canadian Philosophy Show, and we hope that you'll join us next week, where maybe we'll talk a little bit more about maxing and Charles Taylor.
You can find the Canadian Philosophy Show at tcps.podbean.com and on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
Thank you for listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting to you live from Burnaby Mountain.
The annual Sled Island Music and Arts Festival is back June 17th to 21st, presented by Service Credit Union. Experience 5 days of music, comedy, art, and much more in diverse venues across Calgary, Alberta. Joining Sled Island's previously announced guest curator, Clipping, is English Chamber Folk Ensemble, Black Country New Road, revered Canadian pop project Homeshake, renowned abstract rapper Billy Woods, LA synth punk's Sextile, fuzzy indie rock outfit Feeble Little Horse, outlandish egg punk group Snooper, lo-fi post-punk duo Sweeping Promises, New York City-based ambient pioneer Laraji, genre-bending dream pop artist Salami Rose, Joe Lewis, and many more. Plus, there are over 150 more artists still to be announced. Check out the current lineup and get your passes and tickets at sledisland.com.
Speak up. Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.